Hi. I'm very sorry the publicity on today's meeting was not as good as it might have been. Some of you may know that our director of publicity, Gladys Silfo, has been kind of sick the last few days and has not been able to come into the office. And we haven't known from one day to the next whether she was going to be strong enough to come back. And consequently, we didn't get anything out in the bulletin until today. So at least you're here and getting some free coffee and donuts. But one of the tragedies of that kind of preparation is that Gus didn't have a chance to order free milk, so you have to go with this stuff that's $4.34 a pound nowadays, wholesale. I'd like to add my word of welcome to the guys from Christ College in Irvine. Where are you sitting? Are some of you here? Hey, you're real great. How many came?
17.
Just. I hope you're having a good time here in St. Louis. We're a little sorry the weather isn't as good as it usually is. We've had a very mild and lovely winter, and then we got this siege of bad weather. And so maybe we'll have a chance to visit after a while. And on the Insight Ministry weekend, I surely hope that we have a good turnout, and that I was delighted to see so many of you volunteering to help out on that weekend. It's, as you know from my comments the last time we met together up here, the need for pastors is extremely critical, and it gets worse instead of better. I told you, I'm saying this primarily for the benefit of the guys from Christ Irvine, that it appears that by summer we'll have 600 vacant congregations in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And at a time when the overseas churches that are in partnership with us in the cause of the gospel are just crying for help. So if you fellows from California could go back and recruit three or four more for the holy ministry and other church work careers, power to you. The need is very, very great. And I think this kind of weekend that we're going to have on the 29th of April and 30th is a lot easier for us, really, to bring these people here than it is, in many cases, for us to go out there and talk to interested kids. So I hope we have a real good time, and appreciate all of the help that the student volunteers will be offering. I don't propose to make a long speech, but one of the things that I thought you might be interested in was in having me read my manuscript for my latest book. No, I didn't realize this thing was getting that fat. This is the folder in which I keep agendas for the Board of Control meetings of the seminary. And the Board of Control is meeting this weekend on the 15th and 16th, beginning Friday afternoon and going until about noon on Saturday. And from time to time, students ask questions, well, what's going on at the board meeting? And I know more through neglect than through any conscious decision. I have not really been posting the agenda of the Board of Control and letting you know what's going on, but I have nothing against cluing you in advance. And I thought maybe I'd take a few minutes to tell you just what some of the things are on the agenda of the Board of Control as it meets this weekend. And then the other side of the morning's gathering, in my understanding of it, is that you're going to ask questions about anything you want to ask questions about, whether it pertains to the seminary or perhaps to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're coming close to a convention, and there are a lot of things happening that I am involved in because of positions I hold on synodical committees. And for that reason, by the way, we've scheduled another one of these Ask the President forums in early May. The precise date escapes me. I think it's May 11th or 12th, where I think maybe we'll want to talk more precisely about the convention. But if you'd like to raise questions about synod, you do that. For that matter, if you'd like to talk about theology or anything else, that's fine too. I was surprised last week. I was in Phoenix at some development banquets trying to encourage gifts to the seminary last week. And one of my former students came up, shook hands. His name is Jim Is it Bullhagen? And he says, remember me? And I said, oh yeah, I remember your face real well, and I remember some of the things you used to say in class and all of that. And he says, you know, there's one thing I've never forgotten. And I said, what's that? Wondering, what in the world is this going to be? He says, I still remember that there is no reciprocity in the second genus of the communication of attributes. I congratulate him because I had forgotten it. I checked with his wife and made sure he was preaching it faithfully every Sunday and teaching his confirmands. So if you want to talk about reciprocity in the second genus, more commonly known as the genus majestaticum or something, we can do that too. Let me clue you in just a little bit on the agenda of a Board of Control meeting, because it is, I think, gives you a bit of an overview of some of the things that are going on at the seminary. It isn't the whole book, as you can see, but the pages I'm holding up here do constitute the agenda for a typical board meeting. You can see it's a collection of 40 to 60 pages of material, and one reason I don't post it is because our thumbtacks are too short, and I don't really know how to do it. However, let me just mention some items, and if you want further information on some of these things, just ask. Okay, here are some of the things we're going to be talking about. We're going to get a progress report on my attempt to secure funds to install air conditioning and renovate the second floor of Loeber Hall for use as a conference facility. My report is going to be that I've been unsuccessful to date, but it does clue you in on the fact that the board and administration are very much interested in developing Loeber Hall's second floor, particularly, as air-conditioned conference facilities. We may be doing more along those lines, but nothing in the works at this point. I'll be asking the Board of Control for authorization to engage a management consultant. My attempts to increase the efficiency and eliminate some of the other problems that we have in our operations have been pretty much unsuccessful to date, in spite of 2 years of trying to tighten the screws a little bit and so on. I'm talking about the whole area of the business management of the institution, everything from maintenance to custodial services, food services, the grounds appearance, the auxiliary enterprises of the institution. We have been trying internally to do studies to find better ways, more economical, more efficient ways of doing our operation, and we haven't gotten very far. So I'm asking the board for funds to engage a professional to get the job done and get it done fast. Likewise, we will be reporting on what we are calling a campus development plan. We already have board's authorization to engage an architectural firm to look at the plant, the entire plant, in terms of the needs of the institution and the desires of the institution. What to do with the space that we have available. We're not using, for example, a building like Dorm G over here. It is used only about 4 or 5 times a year when we have large conference groups. It was used during Holy Week, for those of you who were here, for a conference of the Christian Brothers group, Roman Catholic group. If you happen to stumble into the chapel and see a tabernacle on the altar, this does not mean that that the Eastern establishment or something has taken over. Sorry about that, Woody. Actually, last year, come to think, this is the second year we had the brothers here, and last year we did have some guests from Southern Illinois who walked into the Chapel of the Holy Apostles, the little one, during, I think it was on Good Friday, and they were in the midst of a little private mass with a tabernacle on there, and boy, that really shook them up. But what are we going to do? What are we going to do with not only with Dormitory G, Seek Hall? What is its long-range potential? We obviously don't need the space in the dining halls for dining. What is Coburg? Could it be renovated and redesigned for a student center or some other use? Pritzloff, right over here, we used to call it E, is not being used at the present time. Should it be redesigned for office space? Loeber Hall, what is its best use? We are interested in a daycare center for kids of the married students. We hope it's limited to married students and so on. And their friends and off-campus neighbors and all of that. Metzger Hall, we are not quite sure about its future. There is the concern about the chapel and where we worship. What is the best long-range plan and short-range plans there? Do we go for a new chapel? We have $93,000 in the treasury gathering interest, but limited to its use is limited to the construction of a new chapel. So we have engaged a firm to do the study, but we haven't really gotten off the ground, and we'll be talking about that. Well, if I go through the whole agenda like that, I'll never make it. We'll be having a discussion on the future of the Center for Reformation Research over here on San Benito, which is directed by Dr. Bob Kolb. What a lot of people don't realize is that while that's an independent organization, the board of directors for the center, the voting members of the center, happen to be our board of control. And what a lot of people don't realize that's even more critical is that the organization is on the verge of bankruptcy. So we have been trying to find a way to preserve the excellent operation that goes on there with a new structural device and new funding, and we'll be talking about that. I'll be giving a report of a meeting that was held on March 26 involving the Board for Higher Education, President Robert Preuss, President Merlin Pohl of Ann Arbor, on the future of the Missouri Synod's educational system and whether we are going to be, I guess the key question is, are we going to think of Ann Arbor, which is the college usually mentioned in this connection, as the preferred senior college route to the ministry, or are we going to go for a preferred curriculum that would be carried on at five colleges of the Synod, namely Seward, River Forest, Bronxville, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Ann Arbor, or some in-between kind of arrangement? There is very little to report other than that the meeting took place. There was considerable disagreement on details, but a general feeling that what we really need to do is to define our objectives in the Synod, our objectives for the Office of the Holy Ministry, and work from there. So the next stage is going to be that one. Part of the problem, and I think you're keenly aware of it because of where you are, a part of the problem is the seminary, this one and Fort Wayne, because while the Synod tries to maintain a system of higher education that coordinates junior college, senior college, and seminaries, what the seminaries are in effect doing, as you know and have experienced in many cases, we are admitting students from outside the system, people who go to state colleges and universities and private colleges and so on, with no real penalty involved, no real benefit appears to accrue to the Ann Arbor graduate in terms of time spent or anything of that kind. And this whole arrangement is being questioned. One of the things we'll talk about, but I hope not too long, we have it in our agenda just about every month, is a report on the name of Seminex. We've had a ongoing, the old timers here, who were here two, 3 years ago will remember it. We've had a paper war going on for quite some time on whether Seminex should be called Concordia Seminary in Exile or not. And even before Seminex was incorporated under that name on June 20, 1974, our Board of Control had petitioned the Secretary of State not to grant that request on the grounds that it would cause confusion and it would obscure the real identity of both institutions. We have worked for the months since then. Occasionally we work. That is, we write a letter, we pass a resolution, we hold a little meeting, we go sit down and talk to John Dom or John Teachin or something and say, why don't you call yourself something else so that Grandma Schmidt out in New Hampshire sends her money here if she wants it to come here and your place if she wants it to go there. And so we don't have this ongoing loss of funds and confusion legally. And the report at this point is not concrete. All we're reporting to the board is that we have some indication that Seminex is about to change its name. and there are rumors around as to what those names might be. One of them is Seminex-Christ Seminary. Maybe you've heard others. And apparently this is scheduled to take place, according to some pretty reliable information, in May, and it's perhaps to be announced in connection with Seminex's commencement service on May 13. If that happens, that would, of course, relieve one of the ongoing sore spots in the relationship between our two institutions. If we could get Seminex also to withdraw its word of God's judgment that it has placed on this institution, it would be my hope, and I have so told the presidents of the other theological schools in St. Louis, it would be my hope that somewhat more normal academic relationships could obtain between this institution and Seminex and all other theological institutions in St. Louis. A major item on the board's agenda this time will be to look at the manuscript of a book that will be published here, hopefully. We've been promising it for almost a year. A report on the walkout. Greg Smith has been working almost full-time on gathering the materials for it and putting it together. So the board will be spending a lot of time on what we hope is the final draft of that manuscript so that it can go to the printer within a week after the meeting and be mailed to those who want copies by June 1. I've already told you a little bit about the St. Louis Consortium. You're probably not touched too much by that. If you are, you can ask. It looks to me like the St. Louis Theological Consortium is on its last legs, largely because Eden and Kenrick have lost interest in it. I am the only president who voted against its dissolution about 2 weeks ago. And I succeeded, I think, in at least getting a successor organization proposed, which would be what's something called a president's council, where the presidents of the theological schools in the St. Louis area would have lunch together 5 or 6 times a year and talk about theological education, or whatever you call such conversations. Usually are a lot of comments about the food and staffing and the latest thing Jimmy Carter has done, and we shake hands and say, wasn't it a wonderful meeting? Something will be continued, but I think this is all to be translated into a statement that means something like this. I think that theological cooperation in the St. Louis area among the 5-6 schools here is not very good at this point, except at the presidential level. We get along great, but who cares? The Dean of Academic Affairs has his usual report. John, are you here? John is. Are you? John, you know, after that April Fool's issue of the Spectrum, we're going to have to get a new color for your... You guys see what we've been using for the Dean of Academic Affairs. That's the yellow section of the yellow pages, which we chose because its length is usually comparable to a typical yellow page edition of the phone book, but... John will be... It's in John Klotz's section where we talk about staffing. I think I've already alerted you to some of the possibilities there. We will be interviewing, the board will, with the electors present, Dr. Clyde Kaminska of Bronxville, with the recommendation from Dean Klotz and me that he be called as professor of practical theology and as director of seminary relations. Whether that's the kind of information that, in many respects, should not be talked about publicly in the church, not because it's secret, but because if for some reason the man is not called, it might be embarrassing to him and the institution. But I think you have a right to know what everybody else knows. I'm told that Dr. Teachin and Larry Neeb came up to Gladys last week in a meeting and said, Gladys, we understand Ralph is bringing in Clyde Kaminska to take your place. And she was quite surprised that they knew I was interested, but also that supposedly he was taking her place. He is not. If anybody thinks that's what this is, you got it wrong, just as Larry and John did. It would be an addition to the staff. It would be to take the position that Robert Gruno once had as director of seminary relations, with Gladys and Paul Essela continuing in their present responsibilities, but with a little bit more help than they've had up till now. We also have a proposal before the board to extend an appointment to Dr. Robert King as guest lecturer in practical theology and special consultant in continuing education and in minority studies. Dr. King is a black man who is presently the director of the graduate school at Lincoln University in Jefferson City. According to the plan, he would teach an elective in adult education, which is the area in which he did his doctorate, as well as an elective on the church's ministry to minorities, a new course that he would develop. And in addition to those two courses, perhaps Dr. Klotz could tell us when they're scheduled at this point, he would help the seminary describe and get off the drawing boards into reality an active program for recruiting blacks and Hispanics and other minority groups and drawing up a curriculum that would meet their needs. And at this point, Dr. King has indicated he is willing to accept.
He probably will accept.
Yeah. Likewise, we're recommending that Dick Warnick, who will soon be installed as a pastor at Ladue, be regarded as a guest lecturer in practical theology for next year, and he would continue to teach a course or two. Dr. Overdwin of Australia, I mentioned his name when we met last, has indicated his acceptance, and he will be here next year as a visiting professor of systematic theology. We're working on the program for Drs. Henschke and Roy Soflo's sabbatical. They are entitled to sabbaticals for next year and have been granted them, but the precise details need to be worked out. Well, these things go on and on. A joint faculty meeting coming up with Fort Wayne in a couple of weeks. We're going to hear reports on our accreditation studies next year. The seminary hopes to receive, for the first time in its history, joint accreditation from the Association of Theological Schools in the United States and Canada, which we have had now for 15 years, 14, I believe it is, and the North Central Association of Secondary Schools, which would give us both theological accreditation and a secular regional kind of accreditation. But it's an awful lot of work, and you'll probably notice all kinds of faculty committees buzzing about trying to write reports on this, that, and the other thing. And we will be reporting to the Board of Control how that is going. Registrar's report is reporting on the number of recruitment trips that have been made and the results that we see there, as well as the current enrollment figure, which is 365. Pleased that it's held its own and actually increased a little since last fall. Dean of Student Affairs, among the things in his report that might be of some interest, he reports on our continuing desire to increase the staff in financial aid and housing, reports on off-campus student housing, and I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, on some of the placement matters of interest to the Board of Control. Those statistics might be of interest. Is Rolly here? Maybe he could give them up to date. At this writing, he says there appear to be about 210 vicarage applications for 180 vicar candidates, 100 from St. Louis, 80 from Fort Wayne. For a while, you know, there was a concern that there might not be enough good vicarage places, but apparently this is taken care of. Likewise, calls for candidates have exceeded 220 for 130 positions, about 50 from St. Louis, about 80 from Fort Wayne. So in that sense, we have the placement process is underway at this time. Placement committees are meeting rather frequently, as you know. Under seminary relations, Paul Essela will be reporting on a number of outreach programs the seminary has going. We've been traveling around a bit to various parts of the country to talk about recruitment and funding, and he will be reporting on those things and others. The business manager's report, rather long, but it includes the information that the day of the board meeting, we hope to open bids from six contractors for the construction of the new married student housing unit at 6701 San Benita. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that the bid will be low enough to enable us to proceed immediately. And if we're as lucky as we were on the bid for Fritz Hall, we will have construction underway, we think, in May already, on the new married student housing unit. Well, that's about the gist of the board's report. Most of the other stuff is what I would call routine, reports of the various activities of the different administrative staffs. I think I've talked long enough about some of these items. Maybe you have other areas you'd like to inquire about, and I would suggest that we just ask questions and talk back and forth. You might want to make statements rather than ask questions. That's fine. And we'll keep going as long as you're game. And if you have to leave early or something, feel free to do that, or to mill about, ask getting coffee, or whatever you wish to do. Well, let me try to field you in order. Dan, I saw you first. Want to go ahead?
We have a problem here with the heat. I'm sure you're aware of it. And I'm concerned not so much because of the discomfort, but because of the amount of money that goes to heating buildings that are already pretty warm. Is there some way we could put an end to that?
You mean it's not just my office?
Oh, no.
The dorms are...
I don't know about the dorms, but the classrooms.
Yeah, it's like sauna.
Chapel, I know, is a little warm. I thought maybe it was that sermon on judgment we had this morning. Let me check into it, Dan. Are the lights still on in dorm G2? I was walking my dog the other night and saw the place lit up like I don't know what. Let me check on it. Woody?
In the beginning of the year, we had some discussion about taxation of vicarages, or vicars, for next year. And I was wondering what the status was in terms of that. The lawyers are going to look into it, and with the IRS and so on and so forth.
Yeah, for those of you who aren't clued in on that, the seminary has enjoyed an exemption from IRS for several years on vicarage salaries, which technically aren't salaries but scholarships, according to that ruling. The logic behind that was recognized by the Internal Revenue Service years ago was that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod sets the standards for its ministry. Among those standards is the requirement that each pastor vicar for 1 year, so the vicarage is not optional, not something you asked to do, but something the Synod asks of you, therefore required part of your education. Furthermore, the seminaries both award academic credit for a vicarage, meaning that it is a recognized form of education and not just work for which you're salaried. And since the congregations, according to the polity of the synod, are members of the synod as congregations, the legal argument goes that what they pay the vicar, and it's generally a fairly uniform figure across the board in the synod, is to be regarded for tax purposes as scholarship. Well, what happened was that, and I'm not faulting Seminex at this point, but simply giving the historical fact. When Seminex tried to get the same kind of exemption for its vicars, it appealed to our ruling, which it obviously knew existed. And IRS pulled this dusty thing out of the files. I think, you know, that's how these things get reviewed, more by accident than by design, and pulled it out of the files and said, what's this? And other Lutheran seminaries, not to mention other seminaries, have not enjoyed a favorable tax ruling on their vicarages for the last several years. I've been in touch with Lloyd Sheneman of the LCA on it, and we're thinking about joining hands and fighting the thing legally together. But to make a long story short, the ruling of IRS, after it reviewed our old ruling, was negative. And we've had very good tax lawyers on it from the very beginning. We've done very little ourselves in the administration. We've let the tax experts, our lawyers are Stoller, Heitzman, and Eder. The work is done chiefly by Phil Draheim, a Lutheran. And this is also the legal firm that works for Synod. But Stoller has engaged a special tax firm simply to handle this problem. This has involved trips to Washington, meetings with IRS. We've lost every round. And the question is still whether we can appeal it. The lawyers continue to await an opportunity to appeal. I don't understand all the ins and outs of it, but in order to appeal, apparently there are two ways that the litigation can be initiated. One of them would be a student who has been taxed for his salary would appeal, and the Synod would support the student appeal. And the other one seems to be even more complicated. So to make a long story short, the matter is under review. We are fighting it as best we can, short of litigation at this point. Legal advice is that litigation probably would not be successful. And it's not very encouraging, because in the other professional fields, internships are taxable in medicine and law, and in some of the engineering professions where it's required, it's taxable, and they really don't think we have a very good chance. We, in turn, have then encouraged, through the Council of Presidents, an increase in vicars' salaries to offset the difference. But the net loser in this kind of an arrangement is the Synod. I think ultimately the congregations will pick up the difference, but it just means that another $50 a month or whatever goes, you know, for every vicar's salary, goes into the tax coffers of the United States. And we've figured out the figures are staggering. It approaches every year close to $1 million. And, you know, we think it's worth the Synod's while to fight it, and I do expect litigation, even though we probably will lose. Marty, was it yours?
I had a question earlier. We were talking about a lot of colleges going for four-year programs like Ann Arbor. I'm kind of concerned how that would affect junior colleges if Board of Control had any thinking along the line of, you know, seeing the need maybe to phase out junior colleges with teacher colleges and ministerial colleges going for 4 years.
The Board of Control really doesn't get into the act. I mean, you know, to give an honest answer, I report these things to the Board of Control, and they talk about it and occasionally pass a resolution to be sent on someplace else. But there is considerable talk about that very question. Part of the problem right now is that the thing that's coloring every synodical discussion of new programs or different programs is money. We are hurting like mad for money in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The present year, Synod has adopted a spending budget that is $3 million higher than the most optimistic expectation of income for the current year, $3 million. Well, how many years can the Synod operate with that kind of deficit spending, assuming that their predictions are correct? And right now, the higher education system gets the major chunk of the synodical budget, and we are constantly complaining that we don't get enough. We get almost $1 million at this institution each year, $865,000 this year, and next year the prediction is $890,000, which, as you do a little arithmetic, it doesn't even take care of the inflation. And the prof's salaries, all of these things, maintenance, heat, wow. All of these things are, you know, we're asking for more money. So what is the Synod saying? The Synod is saying, realistically, one expectation is that within a year, maybe two, we may have to close down up to five institutions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, simply to pay the bills. One of the other options would be, and this has also been seriously proposed, that the entire staff for all but the most essential synodical boards would simply be laid off. You'd keep on you'd keep on board of directors, you'd keep on the board of mission staff, the vice president of synod, the exec for the board of directors, but you'd do away with stewardship, youth, parish education, and a whole raft of people, or some combination of those two programs. So in the middle of all of this, you have questions about the system. Do you retain the junior colleges? A school like Austin, for example, which my percentages are, I shouldn't, especially since we're taping this thing, and I don't know who in the world would read my or hear my comments and seize upon their probable inaccuracy, but the percentage of Lutherans enrolled at Austin, Texas is below 50%. And at a school like Concordia, Milwaukee, the percentage of Missouri Synod Lutherans is below 50%. And I'm not even talking about professional church work students. The percentage of professional church work students in many of these schools is very, very low. So what people are saying is, you know, granted that it's good to run Christian colleges for non-church work students, can we afford it? And particularly then they look at the seminaries. We're always the end of the system, and they say, well, particularly since the seminaries are recruiting people right off college and university campuses anyhow. It evidently works. You know, 35% of our new students this year were from outside the system, and they do rather well. Now, if that's true, do we really need colleges? I don't know where that question leads to, Marty, but it is a very, very serious question. And when you read press releases, I noticed one out on the bulletin board and somebody's newspaper the other day, too, that I was at Seward recently talking about the possibilities of a pastoral training program at Seward. And I always smile at these things because all I was really doing was recruiting. And I always, as a matter of courtesy, visit the president. And if there's a faculty committee or something that wants to talk, we talk. And I do favor, as a matter of personal choice and as what I think a realistic approach to ministerial training, I do favor allowing these schools of our synod full opportunity to train their students in the best kind of pre-ministerial work that they can offer. I think it's ridiculous to have five colleges that have the capability, for example, of teaching Hebrew and have three of them doing it right now illegally. I mean, they have a bad conscience about offering Hebrew. Although basket weaving is okay. And I think this is sort of silly. Well, I'll shut up so you can talk. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say, when you were talking about the five campuses with approved curriculums, if you could add that and make that six in Ad Irvine, you'd appreciate that. It will be supporting and supplying young men and women for full-time work in the church. It's a four-year program. And it does cover the 13 Western states, and we want to be a part of the program too. So we might get that and write it in.
My intention, you're not yet there. I mean, that's my only reason for using five. But the principle would certainly be to include all of Synod's recognized four-year colleges that have the capability of offering a good pre-ministerial curriculum. I think the Synod could, you know, just to flesh that out, I think the Synod could still focus its ministerial training at Ann Arbor or wherever, particularly gear a certain operation for that, just as it would continue to focus on its pre-teacher training at River Forest and Seward in St. Paul, Minnesota. They wouldn't go out trying to drum up a lot of ministerial students and so on, but very happy to include Christ College. I think very highly of it. As a matter of fact, the whole organizational principle of the college that is structured around the Great Commission of Jesus Christ is a very, very natural, I would think, a very natural place for interesting young people in church work careers. Let me turn my head this way so that I don't mean to turn my back on the right. Yes.
Last night I had the opportunity to be around campus rather late and noticed a lot of neighborhood kids or whatever running around, and I think maybe there should be some way, at least a phone number or something that we could call on. This is like at 2 in the morning and the switchboard's closed then. Some way to handle that problem, because I know vandalism and theft is a problem on campus, and with the weather getting warmer, might be,
How old
are kids, would you say? Is there a college age or junior high? Or
I didn't see them that close, but they're making a lot of noise behind the faculty houses, and when I drove by there, they were running across the athletic field. So I would say they're probably high school age or
junior high.
While we're on that subject, is there what is the situation with vandalism, security? Have there been any problems in the dorms of late?
Well,
one of the problems that has happened on occasion, if you leave things in the laundry room overnight, for example, there have been occasions when you come back the next day and it begins strewn all over the place, or even thrown in the garbage or outside or whatever, so that the laundry room is unprotected. It may be the case that it should be locked at midnight and then reopened in the morning if that happens. Whenever the guard goes
out. How about theft from rooms?
Might be good. It's a security guard. I know he's here like until 1 o'clock and then he leaves, but you think if any burglar was going to break in, it would be after 1. I've heard many people say this, you know, like their cars and their lot. The security guard could be on campus like from midnight till 6 in the morning, especially on the weekends. I know he locks up the buildings and, you know, checks, makes sure they're secure with the basket, but
yeah, longer hours for the security guard have been discussed from time to time. It's real obvious that this one-man security patrol can't do very much. And most of these people try very hard and I think have been pretty faithful in carrying out their orders from the firm that provides them. But my son, who's a junior in high school, for example, tells me that the kids at high school say, let's go to, you know, after a dance or after a party, let's go to the Concordia campus. They don't have any security. And that's the reason when I'm out walking my dog and stuff, I find beer cans and all kinds of things all over the place. And the security people tell me that to provide really totally adequate security, it would cost a small bundle, you know, on a 72-acre campus with some buildings not used, and we have far too many keys out, but something could well be done. Phil, you want to finish?
Yeah, well, my question really was, I'm on campus at 2 in the morning. I work at KFUO and I get off about 2:15, and I make a habit usually of just driving around to see what everything looks like, because working down at Seek Hall, I know they've been broken into a number of times. And last night, I realized, the first time I saw anybody, but I realized, well, who would I call? What number? Yeah. That type of thing. That was sort of the question. If there'd be at least, you know, somebody to get a hold of if something is happening, that, you know, like you wouldn't be calling the police yourself if just on a, you know, a whim, because they might not.
Yeah. Right. I should know. I don't know how to answer your question. There is a number. I know that John Drews, in terms of our staff, John Drews has the staff responsibility for security. There is a number provided us by Pinkerton's, the firm that provides our security man for calls when we have difficulties. And Clayton Police have generally been pretty cooperative. But let me get that number. Let me run a notice in the Daily Bulletin or post it on the bulletin boards. Maybe that would be better, to have it permanently posted where what to do and how to do it. We can certainly do that as a very immediate step. Yes, Parker?
Well, in Fort Wayne, I remember this problem occurred. And we had the students volunteer if they'd want to stay up, and well, we got paid for it too. But actually, it was a student patrol that actually patrolled the whole grounds. And this, if we have to go to something like that, that might be an idea.
It gets kind of dull if you don't have any excitement, but yeah, I used to do that sort of thing once in a while. Had a ball once in a while too. Yeah.
Speaking of longer hours for the security, if they went by our plots, they might be here all night. So.
You want to have fix too. Sounds like a faculty meeting, doesn't it, John? Profs don't like the clocks either. I don't understand. You try to have unity and diversity, and as soon as you get a little diversity, everybody hollers. Okay, clocks. We'll put in a requisition to Dallas Convention and see what we can do. Yes.
Did you have your hand up?
I should say a comment about the students.
The student patrol?
Yeah. It worked out really well for them.
Did it? What'd you get paid?
$2.25.
But in the mouth of two or three witnesses. Yes, sir.
You spoke to us, you mentioned the fact that on March 31, there would be a seminar held with faculty to discuss seminary concerns. I was wondering if you could tell us what the content of that thing was and what the implications and or consequences for us might be concerning some of the rights that you're well aware of.
Yes.
We did have a special faculty meeting. I would call it a meeting more than a seminar, because I did most of the talking, and that doesn't constitute much of a meeting, or much of a seminar. Some of the profs didn't think it was much of a meeting either. I have, as you know from our conversations, we've had considerable number of questions from students about the instruction and what we're doing to plug holes in the faculty where we don't have adequate staff. Some of you have observed attitudes in your profs, or you think they're there, that you're concerned about. Questions about the mechanics of good teaching. And a lot of you have talked to me. Some of you sitting around here have been in my home talking about them and in my office. And I think this is a very good thing, a very responsible way to proceed at a school like this, where we have questions, concerns, and suggestions for improvement to sit down and talk about them. First of all, I would think with the person involved, that's just a good professional custom to get used to. And then ultimately with people in the administration, Dean Klotz or me or others. As a result of my perception from talking to students and some profs, that we were in kind of a lull around here. I think the mood, it's hard to gauge where it is today, but I think a significant number of students and staff people have been in a kind of a low mood, in a slump, in February and perhaps to some extent in March. This is not totally uncommon. I mean, I can recall the winter blues myself, and particularly while I was at the seminary, running home to my father and telling him I was ready to quit and join the Army. And after he assured me that they wouldn't take me, I'd come back and give it another whirl. So we had a faculty meeting at which I told the faculty essentially that my perception was that we had a situation where a lot of students were needlessly unhappy, and many of them quite concerned about improving instruction and improving and changing attitudes. Would you please help? And so on. And there followed after that presentation, as I say, my key point was, will you help? Let's be aware of the problem and let's begin to do something about it. As a result of that, both Dean Klotz and I have been meeting with individuals on the faculty where we are aware of questions and concerns about teaching style and so on, and talked about what we have been hearing from you very frankly. And we have also assured the faculty that we will encourage all students, good chance to do it right now, to go talk to the profs themselves, assuring them that this would always be done in a positive, brotherly way, interested in the improvement of what goes on here for the sake of the church. So please do that. I mean, please make your own contacts and suggestions to professors. I think the result of it has been intangible at this point, other than that the faculty expresses a very, I think not surprisingly, a very sincere desire to improve whatever it is doing that isn't adequate. We've talked about seminars specifically on teaching as part of our fall retreat next year, and things of that kind. Now, I'm answering your question in general terms because I don't think it would be appropriate for me to talk about individuals, but we're trying to do something. Now, on anybody want to pick up this one? Okay, Steve?
Yeah, in this respect, why couldn't we schedule sessions like one we're having here, where students and representatives of the faculty get together and just talk about the basic problems of what are we doing in the classrooms? Why are we, you know, studying certain things? Why are we studying other things? Mm-hmm. It seems that there would be that might give more of an atmosphere of community and give and take, which is lacking.
You sense a lack of that too. Yeah, I would be very open to this.
Mentioned that students can go one by one to individual faculty members, and that's true. We need to do that, but there's also a creative spirit that can come out of a group meeting, you know, when we together consider how legitimate is what we are doing. Can we, or should we legitimately doing other things? Should we legitimately do other things in another way?
I would simply say I would assure you that if there are students interested in this, there will certainly be professors interested in it. And it would be a matter of the mechanics of setting it up. Just like the little thing we're doing this morning, we should have been doing this kind of thing, maybe not at this time or in this way, but we should be doing this kind of thing regularly. And if you like it, I like it, and I learn a lot from it. It seems to me that the failure to do this kind of thing stems more from profs who are very, very busy and not even aware sometimes of the fact that there are a lot of questions. I think you tend to assume that everybody knows the answers to what's going on in Synod. I constantly am amazed. I run into somebody like President Preuss, and he starts talking to me about the slate of candidates for the presidential election at Dallas, assuming that I know who's on the slate. And I don't. We assume that because a person is similarly involved that they know stuff that we know. So how many would, just show of hands here, how many would be interested in the kind of informal group sharing with profs on what were you suggesting? Curriculum, teaching styles, things we're not doing and could be doing, things we could be doing. How many would think this would be a rewarding thing to do? It looks to me like it would be sufficiently popular to warrant doing it. Is there a way of picking it up immediately? We have Dave Strohschein.
Could Dave, through this, the officers and Dean Klotz as the faculty's dean, work something up and let's get something going immediately?
Okay, who's next with questions? I've lost track of count. Yes, sir.
The recruitment trip. I just wanted to say that a lot of our fears and questions have been answered, even questions we didn't have. and I know that, I don't know how many people have made decisions to come here or not within the next few years, but certainly we have the information to make those decisions, and I think that's important.
Very good. I'm glad to hear it. How about others? Other comments? Yes. Sorry. Bruce, you went on too? Go ahead.
I realize the financial situation here at the seminary isn't tops, but I was wondering if there's any short-range or long-range plans to restore our triune fountain to its original glory of a year or so ago.
I haven't looked at it lately. Is it still triune, or have we gone binatory in it? We do at least have three, don't we? Okay. Well, I should get a maintenance man to answer that question. What happened about a year and a half ago was that we switched. Well, you know, the fountain, as part of the original design, is part of the air conditioning mechanism for the library. It's a functional pool. It's not just decorative. And if it's that. and the... What happened was that the original design malfunctioned so often that we replaced the air conditioning equipment. We put the towers, as they're called, behind the library as the new way of doing it, so that the pool is no longer part of the functional system. Well, what was thought by some people should be done at that time was to totally disconnect the fountain and fill that area in with dirt and make a little flower garden, put up a flagpole, fly the United Nations flag or something, or some kind of a rock garden, and what have you, something that would be easy to maintain, like grass, or to be more accurate, so it would fit in the rest of the campus, weeds. I have no prejudices against weeds, but we're trying to do something on it. At any rate, we talked it over. We decided let's try this particular hookup. It was possible to do it at low cost without changing the equipment. And I don't know what the... It really hasn't been addressed by anybody since that time. It's just we're using it this way with no long-range plans. However, Mr. Stoddy, Charles Stoddy, the architect that the Board of Control is engaging to do the campus development plan, will be looking at the whole area from an aesthetic point of view as to what should be done now that the pool is no longer a functional part of the air conditioning system. I take it you would like, from the laughter, we should either convert it into a full-fledged swimming pool or something pretty, right? The Triune Fountain is not that attractive. Yes, sir. Oh, add the 12 apostles. That's not a bad idea.
Do you know who Charlie Beckerman is?
Yes.
Do you know how I can get a hold of him?
Yes.
I need to get a hold of him before I go. He's a very special person. And I couldn't get a hold of him.
He is the president of Soderman, S-O-D-E-R-M-A-N, Heating and Plumbing or something like that. You can see me later. I can give you his... I think I can give you his title. Soderman, S-O-D-E-R-M-A-N. The office of his firm is on Mackland Boulevard. Yes?
Yeah, I was just wondering what the reaction of, like, the bookstore management was to the suggestions made last time about having a bookstore system like they had at Yale or something where it would be cheaper.
I must say honestly that since the last meeting, I don't believe anything has been done about the bookstore situation other than a report at the administrative level. We have what we call here President's Advisory Council, which is the dean's level, and me, and we talked about it there. It's part of this management study that I had hoped to undertake. Mr. Bielenberg was doing that for me time released from the library to do it. He has done some digging on the bookstore situation, has some strong recommendations, but we really haven't finished that study, nor have we initiated anything as a result of the comments here last time, Paul. It's very much on the agenda, though. Woody, I'm sorry, let me get Bruce. He's been waving at me, and I keep looking over his...
Yeah, two things. Could, in the repair, could you include the carillon replacing the bell or something?
You don't like that?
Who knows what the last time I checked on it, we had the problem was electrical. It was a missing relay. He hopes he does.
That was my main question. Is there anything being done to unify the two seminaries' policies toward the charismatic?
There is a joint faculties meeting on May 6 and 7 at Fort Wayne. Our faculty is... we're busing our faculty to Fort Wayne.
Freedom Riders.
Can't you just see the headlines now? Especially if we don't stay in the middle of the road. Stay on the right all the way, right. No, I don't know, John, you've been working with the program committee. Is this specifically on the program, or will it be addressed in that Saturday morning session where we talk about cooperation?
Yes, this is specifically on the program. It is planned for... Friday afternoon or Friday evening. This was done because at the time the plan was drawn up, it was thought that President Preuss would also be there at that time, as well as President Bowman. But it is on the program and will be discussed.
Say, so Dave, your topic. Sorry, Dave, while I'm looking at you, we have a meeting at 11:45.
I'm not sure.
That's the Student Faculty Administrative Council. Seems to me we do have one scheduled. Pardon me? Yeah. Well, we better wind it up here. Let's give everybody a chance to ask a question, though, who has one coming. The charismatic thing, I don't mean to slide over a very big problem. I think that's the kind of thing where it would be fun to sit down and talk about once we, you know, exhaust all the news items and the other things, because this is a growing matter of concern, and the two seminaries apparently are not approaching it quite the same way. And Fort Wayne, we're curious as a faculty to know just where they are today, because they went originally into a written policy that they apparently backed off of and are apparently now moving back toward. And while we have felt that the end result in our policies is identical, the two seminaries, I believe. I think our approach to it has been different. And we have to double check it. All I can say is we want a unified approach. We are working toward that end. And matter of fact, you want to know some, the written policy that Springfield came out with was actually a document that was being worked on by the two faculties at the time it was released by Fort Wayne. It was not ready for release, in our opinion, but it was released as a single seminary policy statement. Since that time, we have, and even before it really, we have wondered whether a written policy is a very good idea, unless we're going to have written policies about all concerns. It seems to me that what the church expects of the two faculties at time of graduation is to say with as much conviction as we can that the man, and here is bylaw language, is in every respect qualified for the office of the ministry of word and sacrament. And theologically, that means that the man is a committed Christian Lutheran in all areas of his theology, not just in his attitude toward the charismatic movement. The same would apply to infant baptism, Lord's Supper, and everything else. So we have felt that rather than single out one problem, it would be good to work toward that goal comprehensively and not single out the charismatic student for particular attention, although we do want to give him attention. Yes, sir.
Do you have a policy statement at this time, the seminary here on the charismatic movement?
No, sir.
You do not?
Mm-mm. The CTCR, the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, has a document and now a sequel to that document.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yeah, that I think reflects, I not only think, I know, it reflects the opinion of the faculty rather well as we deal with it. We have serious concerns about some of the theological accents that are associated with the charismatic movement. You know, as movements qua movements, it's an interesting term. It's an anthropological, sociological term. That is not to say that every person who calls himself a charismatic adopts the theology of the movement, but we have concerns with some of these theological points. A tendency to place the experience of something called the baptism of the Spirit above of the means of grace, a tendency sometimes to downplay the significance of water baptism, a spirit of elitism, as though the Christian with the second experience might be a superior grade of Christian. And you can go on and list your own list of abuses. There are abuses, however, in all areas of our life as Christians, and I don't mean to particularly fault this group. It is something that we try to deal with. We do not have a written statement. We believe in treating each person as an individual and trying to work through the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions with each person to help one another profess together our common adherence of Lutheran doctrine. Yes?
One quick question. Do you know of any official response in the work or any semi-official response to the book that just came out yesterday, Price of Missouri?
The book by Jim Adams, Price of Missouri and the Great Lutheran Civil War, which sells for $10, Harper and Row, $8.50 in the bookstore. I read it last week. It's an interesting book. I don't. I think Jim Adams, if he was probably already recognized as one of the best religious journalists in the country, I think this book will firmly cement his reputation as a religious journalist. And he's an honest one. He told us he was doing impressionistic reporting, and he certainly was. A lot of his observations are very, very interesting and very, very accurate. Others are very inaccurate, and his work, just like anybody else's on a big area, is selective. It gives an impression because of what it fails to report sometimes. But I don't know of an official response to it. I really don't. I know that it would probably be reviewed in journals, perhaps our own, perhaps in the the Fort Wayne Journal. But I don't honestly know of any. Do you, John? Have you heard of any official responses to it? Anybody have? I haven't. Phil?
No, I haven't. I just have a comment on him. I watched him report the convocation that was here.
Yeah.
Second year,
And the day that you had the presentation with Bowman from CMX, this might just be for take it for what it's worth, but he was writing your presentation and your responses and everything that was happening at that meeting while the papers were being read. When the meeting and the responses and questions actually took place, he had already left and evidently filed his report. So when the paper came out, it talked about it being a fiery session when it was nothing but conciliatory. So
yeah, that was. I remember his story on it. It was, in fact, I called him about it. And I have a very good relationship with Jim Adams. I mean, I must personally say that while many people in the Missouri Synod have been critical of Adams' journalistic techniques, he has treated me, I think, very well. You know, I consider him a very good, a very competent professional journalist. And I think he has said some very nice things about this seminary and about me in his, right? For example, the first few times he wrote stories in which he used my name, he always called me Yale-educated conservative. And I thought, gee, that's not bad. That sounds pretty good. Or soft-spoken conservative. He always had some kind of a, you know, something I could tell was puzzling him about me. And one time he wrote a story, it was on page 3 of the Post-Dispatch during the height of the controversy, something like, Lutheran church executives threatened to resign. And one of the two executives, who, according to his story, had threatened President Preuss that we would resign if he went through with his hard-headed policies toward the former faculty, as Adams called them, I was one of them. Vic Bryant and I supposedly had told Preuss, if you go ahead and get tough with the seminary, we'll resign, which was interesting to read. It was total fabrication. I don't know where in the world he got it. So I called Jim. I went to Vic Bryant first, and I said, okay, how do I answer this guy? What do I do? Do I write a letter to the editor? What do I do? He said, why don't you pick up the phone and call him? And, which I found an interesting approach, and I did. I told him I don't know where in the world you got that information, but you're just dead wrong, and it doesn't do me any good to have stories like this floating around, and I intend to answer it one way or another. What's the best way? Well, his response, I tell people this story, was very professional. He was very sorry. He said that he took my word for it. He hoped that he hadn't hurt me, and he was interested in correcting his mistake, he said. And he said he would try his best to get equal space and time for his retraction of the statement. Now, he published a correction, but it appeared on page 33 in the food ads or something down in the lower column. But he did try, and I give him credit for that. Jim is a very sensitive, he studied for the Roman Catholic priesthood at one time. He has a master's in theology. He's a fairly bright fellow, and I think in the conclusion he tips his hand very well. He is still a Roman Catholic in his view of the relationship between church and scripture. Scripture is the product of the church rather than the other way around. That doesn't differ significantly from Robert Cardinal Bellarmine in the 16th century. And I think his view of historical criticism is a typical contemporary Roman Catholic point of view. Namely, you don't have anything to worry about with historical criticism because whether or not the text as we have it is the inspired word of God, it at least comes from the early Christian community and therefore is inspired. Since the community is inspired by the Spirit, the product of the community is just as valid whether it's tradition or canon. So I think Jim's fundamental approach theologically is moderate, no doubt about it. It's even Roman Catholic moderate. And in terms of the Synod's struggle, since he doesn't really regard the controversy as being a valid theological controversy, given his theological perspective, he sees the whole thing as political. And therefore, while his work is very careful and meticulous, and he has investigated like crazy and talked to a lot of people, it seems to me the dimensions of the story that he paints are all political, almost. I mean, there's some theological reflection in there, but it's largely political. And I don't think that does justice, frankly, to either the Seminex point of view, or certainly not the point of view of President Preuss. Well, I don't want to keep you guys if you feel like... Okay, go ahead.
This is a question back to the number of seminaries and the number of formal institutions that we have. And since there are challenges here in staffing, and we're also challenged to use this facility to its fullest, you talked about perhaps redesigning certain areas, and that would involve a great deal of expense. What are the primary difficulties in combining the two seminaries that we have now?
Well, I don't know. That question, that possibility was, I understand, was looked at for a very brief time in right before Anaheim in 1974 and 5, when there was Task Force on Higher Education that brought in a report to the Anaheim Convention. And I think, as a matter of fact, I was asked about its possibility in the floor committee sessions prior to the Anaheim Convention, and said that I was interested in that possibility because it seemed to me that one seminary could diversify its programs sufficiently to do a very first-rate job. And I think I would have to say that from that experience, that the concern about it, the negative feeling about combining seminaries, is largely, put sort of colloquially, it's that competition is good for the synod. That two seminaries, both engaged in similar pursuits and turning out men for the same ministry, serve a check and balance as a check and balance upon each other to some extent, so that the synod would not have to contend with the possibility of a real power block that a single united seminary would become. And what I sensed in the floor committee discussions was that kind of feeling, that having just gone through a problem and still going through it, which is to some extent at least the result of an extremely powerful institution here, which prior to 1969, I mean, I know it from personal experience, and others do too, was the very nerve center of the synodical administration. I mean, one of the reasons why the election of Jack Preuss was objected to so strongly in 1969 is because of what it meant for political control by this faculty of the synod. Now, having gone through that kind of an experience, I think what the average folk in the synod were saying was, we don't want that big, powerful institution again on any one seminary campus. And if you combine the two, you're going to be breeding a giant that may control the synod rather than be the synod's servant. To which I have always responded, I don't think that follows. What you would need to do would be to adopt bylaws, lines of responsibility, that checks and balances of a different kind. You could, for example, have the president of the institution have a terminal four-year contract. You could have everything, you could have the board of control always responsible to another board. You could have two or even three tracks of ministry programs going on at the seminary under somewhat different controls in the Senate. And I think if a people were really willing to work at it, it could be done. You know, whether it should be done, I really don't know. In terms of efficiency, cost, and all of that, we could handle it right here. Using just our regular classrooms and so on, with the regular schedule available to us, not even running evening classes and the like, what does that study show, John? It's right around 1,000 students we can handle in terms of classroom facilities. With 57% of our students married, and an even higher percentage married at the Fort Wayne Seminary, the dormitory, single dormitory facilities would be adequate. In fact, before the break, several of the dormitory rooms were unoccupied then. So, there are many things going for it in terms of cost. The library, it would enable the Synod to put together one fantastic library. In terms of graduate program, which is really expensive, because classes are so small, and Fort Wayne is trying to do its thing in terms of graduate school, and so are we. Neither of us has as good a program as we would have if we could somehow combine. I think the thing merits a good hard look, but the fear has been that of empire building, I think. Well, got Dave, do you want to go to a meeting?
Yeah, but anybody who has any want to volunteer for inside ministry.
Okay. Let's just take one or two quickies. I really think we better go ahead with our scheduled meeting. We have such a hard time sitting down finding those times. Yeah, let's do one or two more, please.
This is just kind of an impression again. It's a little out of your field. But I get the impression many times that certain other publishing houses, InterVarsity, Sondervan, and others seem to be doing a much more aggressive and useful job in a lot of the things that they're putting out, and quite often a lot more reasonable price. And I was wondering if you could share what the problem is with CPH.
John, are you still on the Commission on Church Literature? No, you're never. You're with Editorial Commission. Well, a lot of us have questions about it. It is not. CPH is evidently having a rough go financially. A part of the problem financially is the there have been some bad mistakes made in the past. The Mission Life Sunday School materials. I have heard conflicting figures on the amount of inventory on hand at CPH from those materials. They just didn't sell, aren't selling. It's in the millions of dollars, just sitting on the shelf. I really don't know. I know only that seminary faculties talk about it. We had a dinner with Ralph Reinke at his expense last fall, and he went up to Fort Wayne, did the same thing with that faculty. The Commission on Church Literature is talking about it. I feel for you and for this concern, but I really don't know how to get a hold of it. Well, why don't we call it a day? Okay? Thanks for coming, and we'll do it again.